Welcome back to our second kind of abbreviated segment of Cambridge Inside Out.
All right.
Yeah.
And
we zoomed into Google. Let's put it that way. We had a few.
Right. We're doing
a Google. Host,
we're two hosts in search of a platform.
Right. Well, yeah.
Right. Okay. Anyway, this will do for now. Okay. So one of the other items that was instead of long in coming, really. Based on that came up at the city council meetings last night, October 5th meeting, had to do with, it was a response, not just from the commissioner of police, but also from human services on various ways of, alternate methods of doing policing.
Right.
Part of it was sort of part of this national outcry for defund the police, abolish the police, which...
Right.
You know, it was a little silly, but the thing is that if you take it on its face, it's silly,
right.
The thing is that embedded within there was just a notion of doing some alternate ways of doing policing, which is something anybody who's actually followed in Cambridge knows we've already been doing that for a good long while. Whether
right.
we should be doing additional things should be the question. It shouldn't be whether we should be raising banners saying defund the police. It's a matter of,
again,
what else could we be doing?
It doesn't mean abolish the police. It means transforming funds or taking funds, whatever. I mean, it was an unfortunate phrase that has become part of this election.
You know, just as they say, beauty is in the eye of the beholder.
Yeah.
I think intent is in the voice of the speaker.
Yeah.
And in many regards, there are some people who literally mean abolish the police.
I know. This was back in May after the George Floyd. And the minute I heard that, and my daughter, who's younger, we all said, this is going to be it. This is the worst thing that could have happened.
Right. It led to kind of a lot of hullabaloo. I believe it was at the summer meeting or even the June, was it the last June meeting?
Before, yeah.
Yeah. But the thing is, it was very much sort of a central focus on it. And then there was a request that the police commissioner and others come back with a response, right? After all, they were going to start cutting their budgets and doing all this stuff.
Yeah.
So what came back for last night's meeting was actually a very thoughtful, very informative response from Commissioner Bard, but also from Ellen Seminoff and the people at Human Services and others.
Right. Yeah.
Basically laying out some, what do we do and, what are some things we might consider? And I thought it was a very, very well-considered statement.
Yeah.
So it was kind of good to see, but I don't know that necessarily puts to sleep some of the demands that some people will continue to make,
but I think it was welcomed by some of the more fierce kind of critics or people that didn't. I think Mark McGovern, given his background, made some really great points about how this. I mean, you can't completely have the police out of the question.
I think the great naivete of what some people were promoting was that somehow when you get a call that a dispatcher, when you call 911, is just going to go, oh, okay, fine, we'll just send a social worker out.
Okay,
but there's no way that the dispatcher, just based on the phone call, necessarily understands the complexity of a situation.
But you bring up a point, though, that I was thinking about is maybe do they look at dispatch? I mean, I don't know how well dispatchers are trained in trying to ascertain what is necessary. That's all.
I think that Commissioner Bard actually at the meeting did address this. Yeah. And the thing is that any modifications in the way we do protocols will have to be done in coordination with the emergency communications.
Obviously, yes.
Right?
You hear about things, around the country about 911 calls. Sometimes it's gotten wrong or something. So, I mean, yes, an emergency, but you do need more information and maybe have some input into, is this something that, do we send out the crisis team? Do we send out two people? Whatever. So I have no idea. I don't know.
It is not uncommon. And again, my brother is a cop and I speak to a lot of police officers. It is not uncommon that you can get a call that appears to be, a squabble amongst people. But when you actually get there, it turns into something far worse. Or you may say somebody is having a bit of a psychological episode, But when you get there, it turns out the person has a weapon and is using
it. This is I told
with
you.
Deadly intent.
In the 80s, when I guess we had a crisis center and the police actually used us, the counselors, to go out to people's houses. And I was in a situation. We used to go out in twos, but somebody did. It was in a closet with guns. And you know what? I do not remember what we did. We probably did call the police and the person was committed, but we went out first. And I don't think that model's around anymore. You wouldn't actually go out by yourself like that, but I don't know.
I think Mark McGovern actually made a comment that so basically anybody, if you're going to do this with sort of a social worker, you always do it with at least two.
Oh, right? Yeah. You would never go. No, we were right. These were this was like on call in the middle of, you know, like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But anyway, I you know, I just, I'm kind of hopeful that some of the fervor will die down.
Yeah.
And reason can prevail here, because the thing is, I think, you know, when you think back, everybody, it was a lot of hot heads in the summertime about this. But when you really think about it, I don't know that there's really all that much disagreement on the basic notion that sometimes there are non-police ways of handling situations.
De-escalation, the whole thing about
de-escalation, whatever. I don't think anybody ever disagreed about that.
Yeah.
But it was this hostility based on some people who.
Well, I don't think really even had the knowledge of what do the police do? Do they have these, you know, some people just came out and just figured they just come out with guns and that's it. You know,
it's right.
Well, mention something that Bard said about the CAHOOTS program, because that was sort of interesting.
Was that the one that's in Eugene, Oregon they were doing?
Yes.
And right.
So not for a long time, and the funding source of that.
Right. So the thing is there are many people who, because it almost becomes politicized that they want to, we need to be able to say that we defunded the police or we took it out of the hands of the police. But what was revealed was that the program that they were using as a model in Oregon actually is funded and managed under the jurisdiction of their police department. It's a little closer to what we do, you know. It's just so it's really a matter of, are there some elements of how they do things?
It may be more autonomous. I mean, I don't know all the details of it, but I just thought that was
really good. You know, and we may decide that there are certain functions that could be made more autonomous as well. I think it's a perfectly reasonable conversation, but it needs to be more of a conversation as opposed to a demand all the time, you know, and where people are basically getting up on soapboxes and trying to score political points. It doesn't make any improvement.
I think it's because we pay them so much. I don't know. All right. I'm sorry I said that. But now they have assistants that are being paid just about $20,000 less than they are now.
Think about the city council.
The reality is that they do most of the work. I don't know.
Right. I don't know about that. You know, all right. So it seems like we're pivoting a little bit toward
charter review.
Charter. Okay. So another item other than the city manager's contract extension, but that's a whole nother story, is basically, so it was Councillor Patty Nolan has decided. Yeah. I don't really know what the motivation is, quite honestly.
Because charters are supposed to be reviewed every 10 years and ours hasn't been.
I don't know that there really is a suppose to it.
Those people said it.
They established, I think, under Deval Patrick's administration, this entity that, you know, sort of would assist municipalities throughout Massachusetts in looking at charters, drafting new charters, reviewing charters. So they are of the opinion that you should be looking at it every 10 years, but I don't know that there's any set rule about that.
I don't know. I have to look at my notes on that meeting.
So let's have a review of the charter, no sooner as people talk about having a review of the charter, I start reading on the listservs about, these are the demands that we must do. We have to get rid of this and we got to change that. And we're mad at the city manager because he isn't giving us municipal broadband right away. Yeah. And so therefore we should therefore have a directly elected mayor, you know, and it's like, okay, so it's not, are we really talking about a review or are we talking about some catering to some people who just want to do some wholesale changes?
Yeah.
You know, I might actually make the argument that, the fact that, you know, people say, well, we've been using our charter for 80 years, so therefore it's time for a change. I might actually make the opposite argument, which is that if we've been using a system for 80 years, and by most accounts and most objective accounts, it's kind of been working fabulously. then where's the demand coming from?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the thing is, in terms of Cambridge's ability to respond to the pandemic, as just as one example, the ability to, you know, to do many things, really, you know, taking on initiatives, you know, of all sorts. It seems like we seem to be able to do this. And partly because we have a city, I would argue, partly because we have a city manager form of government, as opposed to a strong mayor who comes, says, this is what I want to do to make myself famous during the years I'm in office. And then they go, and then another mayor comes in and says, well, this is what I want to do to be remembered. You know, as opposed to a more of a steady hand at the wheel, which is what city manager form of government tends to provide. You know, so do you want greatest hits type government, or you want, you know, a calm hand at the wheel? And, you know, the notion that somehow the city manager is somehow not responsive to the council, I think it doesn't really line up with the realities. You know, yes, you can always point out some particulars about municipal broadband, or, you know, we demanded street closures and he was slow in getting to that, you know, terrible, right? But then in the end, you know, for example, with the shared street initiative, so he was slow in getting to it, but then in the end, how enthusiastic are people about it now that it's actually been in place for a while? Apparently not so enthusiastic. So are we supposed to, like, just the manager, therefore the manager should have jumped and done, well, maybe the manager understood some things that that the counselors didn't. So,
well, also, so speaking of, you know, the way cities are run, we were talking about that earlier off camera, on other cities that more often than not have a city manager or a CEO or a town manager kind of form of government.
Yeah, if you look across the entire country, a city manager or town manager form of government is far more common than strong mayor forms of government.
Let me bring up Berkeley, California. We're often, you know, we're compared to that. They have a population similar to ours, I believe. They have an elected city council and they appoint their city manager. It's called their CEO. The citizens directly elect councilors elected by district, which is interesting. And the mayor is elected at large. So they have a mayor, but they also, and they have no assistants, by the way. they do get $132,000, but they have no assistants. But anyway. And they also elect the rent board, the school board, and I mean citizens, and the city auditor. So, you know, I'm just saying. In Seattle, also has a they have a mayor, but they have a mayor council. I forget. Anyway,
I mean, there's a lot of different hybrids.
Of course, Seattle's got 3 million people, or something.
Right. I mean, even Worcester, which is a Plan E city initially.
Worcester.
Eventually, they chose to switch to have a directly elected mayor.
They did.
But they may retain the city manager. The manager still runs the city.
And you know what they get paid? Really very little. I looked at this as of January 2020. I think the councilors were paid $33,000 or something, and the mayor less. They're not supposed to be full-time type people, I guess. I don't know.
Well, I mean, I'm sure you will find a 0 out of 9 agreement among city councilors with my point of view, which is that they shouldn't be paid too much, because they shouldn't view this as sort of a lifelong job.
No.
And it was never designed as a full-time job, nor should it be viewed as a full-time job.
Know.
I don't think it's even helpful to view it that way.
And then having an aide, I mean, it brings both of, it's like $150,000 per counselor that they can control. It makes no
because
sense.
They want it. That's all.
I know.
You know, I would argue really that, so tell me, if the city charter hasn't changed in 80 years, tell me, has the job changed? you know, honestly, the job is pretty much defined by the charter. So I would argue the job hasn't particularly changed. And I would also argue that before the year 2000 or 2002 or three, when they first started jacking up council salaries, were city councilors particularly ineffective? Were they particularly uninformed? Were they dreadful councilors? Was Alice Wolfe a terrible city councilor because she's before the day when they had aides and high salaries and whatever? I would actually argue that they were some of the most effective And knowledgeable counselors in the history of the city actually predate the days when we were actually paying them five times as much.
Yeah.
You know, plus the additional payment for what began as research assistants and then became personal assistants. The job title, the names, and the salary has just continued to grow and grow and grow.
And for some of the counselors, this is really, they're treating it, which they should, as their full-time job, because they don't necessarily have other jobs. I mean,
right.
I would say that's at least three or four of them. I don't know.
But, you know, honestly, I have to say, I mean, historically, there were city councilors did a lot more in the way of so-called constituent services. And that tended to be the thing that tended to be very time consuming.
Oh, I think some of them do a lot of that.
Some of them do that, right? But the thing is that as one former city councilor said to me, he said that one time as we were walking along Mass Ave one night, he said that to whatever degree residents feel the need to call a city councilor, that is one measure of the fact that something isn't working well in the city. All right. So I'll give you an example. If I was upset about something in a park around the corner from me, you might say, well, let me call up Public Works, or let me call up this and that, not necessarily call a city councilor.
Sure.
If you feel that you have to call a city councilor, that probably means that the city isn't doing a particularly good job at sort of showing you the on-ramps to city government.
All right. I think it's more that people feel more empowered, younger people, and they see city councilors as the route, as an avenue to get their, not negative, but what they want. So it's more like you work for me, kind of like, rather than, you know what I'm saying? It's just like, it's become, you represent me. I want you to do this, this, and this. It's
all right. But I very much remember one, you know, city councilor who was a friend who would show up for work at the city council office. They didn't have for separate offices.
Yeah.
But what she would do is she'd be in the office and then the phone would ring. She would actually take the calls.
Yeah.
So when you're calling, you weren't necessarily getting a staff person, you were getting an actual city councilor.
Yeah.
And what she chose to do, it's how she chose to define her job, is she would then put that person on the other end of the line in touch with the appropriate people in the appropriate city departments, maybe with a little, hey, you know, can you take care of this person? I think this is a really legitimate thing. Can you, you know, look into that? So city councilors, the way they did a lot of constituent services is they were basically steering people in the right direction. If you were a person who was seeking housing, there's actually something a little bit unsavory to me about the fact that this city councilor somehow was able to strong arm housing, get somebody into housing ahead of somebody else. But the thing is that you can actually steer them toward the right people in the housing divisions so that if whatever housing services are available for this city, that they actually do right by people.
Actually, it's good now that we have someone like Maura who you could refer to, because that person should be doing that.
Right.
But you had met a long time ago before the whole, I mean, Craig Kelly talked about that, or maybe you did. God, I miss Craig Kelly. But anyway, about the council, instead of having like these little fiefdoms, that they should work together to solve these problems, like the AIDS could maybe, you know, work together and like, what's the, I don't know. It just seems.
Once upon a time when Jim Browdy was on the council, he actually proposed having an office of, basically an ombudsman, you know, so that. To sort of do that, but then he kind of got voted down because the counselors wanted, you know, a friend of mine once wrote an essay, I think he wrote it for the Cambridge Chronicle, where he used a phrase that I never forgot, which is that city councilors benefit from the existence of a problem. I mean, he was writing it primarily in terms of some of the structural flaws during the days of rent control, where in fact, the fact that it wasn't working well, or it was working, you know, it was hard on some people, meant that the political people would always have a job because you could, you know, you're either getting people who are thrilled about it or want to strengthen it or want to destroy it or whatever. And you're always going to be relevant in that case.
Right.
If you actually made the whole system work perfectly, then everybody go, okay, we don't need you anymore.
Yeah.
You know, so they do tend to, thrive on the existence of a
problem. Well, that's probably true of a lot of things in life.
Really. Maybe so.
Yeah.
You know, but But anyway, I have never been convinced that somehow if the charter didn't change, that somehow miraculously the job description of a city councilor has changed. If it has changed, it's because some people have decided that in fact they want to redefine the role in particular ways. Now, I don't necessarily, I mean, you can't say, well, that's wrong, because I guess you can define it in whatever way you want, right?
Right.
But for example, if you see your job as a city councilor and your aide is to actually operate almost as like a political organization within the city council, where you are helping to organize rallies in front of city hall and whatever to sort of, you know, raise some hullabaloo, which is in fact what has happened in recent years. Right. Well, that's fine. But, you know, there are plenty of activists outside of City Hall who are not on the city dime who are more than happy to do that for free and always have, you know. But, as a city councilor, I don't think we should be paying you to be basically a political activist. I mean, that's never been part of the job.
But that's interesting, because I think in some ways that's sort of how some people see their role in a way.
Right.
But that's true, not just in Cambridge.
Yeah. And there's also the other matter, which is that if you would actually lay out the legislation and whatever, and just lay it out and look at it objectively and say, how many full-time jobs does this actually add up to? And in fact is, you can't make the math work in terms of what people seem to be wanting to justify.
Yeah.
I mean, if you want to basically be out there politicking, trying to, you know, get as much face time in amongst this group, that group's, all the time, you know, because that's what politicians like to do. Well, that's well and good, and that's your choice. But that, to me, is not the role of the city councilor. Well, that's more the role of the political candidate.
But they're always running. It's every 2 years. That came up,
you know,
too.
Well, but the thing is that, you know, I think in many respects we would benefit by having the joy of being a counselor being a little less so that it's just such it's a civic duty that you do, you know.
Then the salary does not indicate that, because granted, you know, $85,000 maybe, you know, if you want to live in Cambridge and you've got a fan, whatever, maybe, unfortunately, maybe that's not a lot of money. But for a lot of people, it is. Plus, that's not counting benefits and everything.
Well, and I'll tell you another thing, too, which is that most city councilors have partners, they have families, there are other incomes involved. Some of them are continuing to do other jobs and bringing in additional income.
So it's
income.
Not like,
you know, just like if we want to demand that Donald Trump show his taxes, right, maybe we should demand that as a matter of ethics that all city councilors should declare their combined family incomes.
And then base their salaries?
Basically, to sort of make the case that the salary, the rather high salary that you make as a city councilor, with all the benefits plus the aides and all of that stuff, is not a particularly justifiable level.
I think for a city this size and for what we do, I question it. I mean, you know, Boston is what, 700,000 people, and you know,
But I think some of by tradition or by law, some of the district city councilors in Boston.
Oh, they can pay well.
Right. But the thing is, they actually have a little bit of authority within the districts that under in our at large system, we really don't. I mean, the thing is city councilors are in charge of no city department.
Well, that's a good point, because they have a whole system.
At least in principle, they have exactly three employees they're responsible for managing. The manager,
you're right.
The auditor, and the clerk.
You're right.
Right? But, you know, once they choose them, then they've got like typically three-year terms or a three-year contract or more.
Right.
You know, so the thing is, there isn't really a whole lot of hands-on management as part of the job, you know. So I just think there's a lot of fiction being spun when city councilors talk about the job.
One more thing. Yeah, Portland, Oregon has one of the last commission form of governments. I never even heard of that. They have a mayor and they have four commissioners that are elected. And the members only have legislative and whatever. But it's interesting. It's just
when
like,
we have Plan E. When city forms of government, the charter forms were first created, back in, you know, over 100 years ago, There was plans A, B, C, and D. Plan E came along late. That was like the new kid on the block around 1937 or 8, 1938 it was established, with proportional representation on top of a city manager, a council manager form of government. But there was always, I think it was Plan C, was a commission form of government. And I believe nobody, that was never adopted ever by any city in the city, in the state. No, I'm talking about in Massachusetts.
Oh, right. Yeah. No, yeah. It's interesting.
But, you know, there's one other thing I that
did. We only have, let's see.
I'll just sort of say it on the quick
minute
here.
Minute and a half. We have a minute.
Right. Just on the quick here, which is that one of the things, because I talk to people who are advocates for ranked choice voting and proportional representation, and I'm considered a bit of an expert in some of this stuff. And one of the real truths is that proportional representation elections are typically, at least in this country, were never established unless it was in conjunction with a governmental form that had a strong city manager. There was an understanding that proportional representation is very good for representativeness, but very bad for governance. So that you needed a, quote, weak council that was very much the voice of the people. That was the ideal. But where the actual reins of government would be in the hands of somebody who was a stronger manager.
Everyone should read the Collier article that you have posted on your website.
It was so it was referenced actually in that special meeting that we had. And I said, wow, how come I never heard of this article? So I went looking around and I found it.
Good for you.
Yeah. And I think I may even on eBay pick up the original magazine so I can scan the photos. Goodness. There are some images that in there that I did not include.
But it's excellent.
But it tells us, it tells a great story of, it was, even though it was written 8 years after, after the the victory of Plan E. But that's where
We have to say goodbye. We'll see you on October 20th, I guess, right?
That's
our next show.
First and third Tuesday.
Yeah. Bye.
See you then.